pop this can when I
atmosphere. Oh my gosh. Yeah, no, licking, licking your fingers. You're like a one of those cringy TikTok videos. Oh gosh.
I have my fairy lights behind me too, right? So
that's going back to like that's like season one stuff right there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Welcome to the Voyage Podcast, a show that traverses the oceans of myth and legend through the lens of Catholic theology and philosophy. Come aboard as we set sail in pursuit of the heroic life and Christian virtue with your hosts, Mike Schramm and Jacob Platty.
Well, we're going to be talking, it's appropriate that we're going back seasons because we're going to be talking about many seasons today, or at least I'm going to, and you're going to sit there and listen. We're going to, We're going to
It's crazy how, cause I mean, that was, we haven't had a Hulu subscription in a while. So that goes back to when I watched Fargo, cause I haven't watched it cause it's always been on Hulu pretty much exclusively. So,
Well, let's get into it.
Yeah, let's get dark. Is this our first Coen brothers work? And I know the show is, well, the show still kind of is produced, isn't it, by them?
But it is produced by them.
It's not directed like the movie.
No, it's definitely a Noah Hawley production. I think that Coen brothers produced that in the same way that like you always just got to like, it's probably a legal thing, you know, or they have like an honorary, production, you know, hey, what do you guys think of this?
They weren't sitting in the studio the whole time. Yeah, sort of thing.
Yeah. So I don't know, but hey, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they're like super involved with it.
And if we talk more about the movie, then yeah, this will be like our first Coen brothers, I guess.
And we will. I do want to talk about the movie. Yeah, I actually think it's valuable. We haven't even said, we're going to talk about Fargo today, right?
Yeah, yeah, welcome everybody this episode of the Voyage Podcast. Like I said, I'm a little rusty. Even though this won't be necessarily airing like months later, it's probably been, at least a month since we actually got down and recorded?
Uh-huh. Yeah, so that's true.
Before the new year. So
do I sound sultry? Because I'm like a little congested.
You're gonna take everyone behind the veil and say that you're getting over a cold?
Sound like Johnny Cash or something like that. Okay, or maybe that's just we'll in my head. That. It's just the reverberation in my head that makes it sound.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I don't know.
You know how it is when you hear yourself on tape and you're like, is that what I sound like? Well,
yeah. Well, I'm going to find out when I edit this thing. We'll see if my voice is actually deeper, if it's just me wishing it was.
So even though this is kind of your baby, I'm going to move us along, Jacob.
And, okay.
You
just have to be in control of things, don't you, Mike?
Well, you know, you keep reminding me there's so much content but there's so many themes to kind of touch upon we'll just kind of expound upon throughout the Fargo movie. Fargo, you know, you wanted to talk about season 5 was the most recent one.
That's right, season 5. We'll get to season 5 for sure.
So we'll kind of just make our way through the Fargo movie, Fargo anthology series. And I think the great thing about this, though, even though maybe because it's an anthology series, is that it's probably playing with a lot of similar themes. And like we both said, too, Coen brothers like to play around with a lot of similar themes throughout all their movies, too. And
certainly.
So even though, like, let's say, for example, you have only seen season 1.
Who would only have seen season one though, Mike? That's crazy talk.
Or you've maybe only seen seasons 1 through 3 and then, or whatever, or you've only seen the movie because that's by far the foundational work for these other ones.
That is true. Yeah.
You're still going to be able to resonate with a lot of the stuff we're talking about. I think that's fair to say, right, Jacob? You're
going to agree with me.
You have to.
Yes, you are correct as always, Mike. If people aren't watching this TV show, I do recommend it. I do think that the quality is waning as the time goes by, but season one, I think is universally loved and as well by me. And probably one of the best seasons of television, like ever. I'll go on record and say that season 1 of Fargo is one of the best
very compelling, very watchable. Like you just, you have to, like, I remember watching it very quickly. Like I didn't see it week by week. I think that's how it may have first been released. Cause it was on FX before it was Hulu.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Well, and it's still like produced by FX. I'm not sure how that works, but like, it's still a thing. It's a Disney property now, Mike.
Oh, maybe someday
FX
we will
is owned
get
by
to.
Fox and Fox is bought by Disney, which maybe is why in season five, in season five, they have a bunch of Nightmare Before Christmas references. They even have some music from it. And it's like, ah, you were bought by Disney.
Synergy.
Now you have Disney stuff in you. Season five is almost like Halloween-y, frankly. It kind of takes place over the course of Halloween and in close proximity to it. Kind of interesting. A little bit of a Halloween-y Americana type thing.
So
let's go back to the beginning.
Exactly. Yeah. Let's maybe go through the movie premise or the movie kind of story, if you want to walk us through that a little bit, that synopsis.
Well, everybody loves the movie Fargo. And if you don't love the movie Fargo, then there's something wrong with you. It's great. I mean, it made a huge splash. Came out in 1996.
Oh, that's
and
a good
no
word
one
for it.
It made a huge snowball. I don't know.
I was referring to the wood chipper scene, but yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's true. Made a lot of noise.
Yeah.
Made an impression on people. But, you know, because really it was such a clever thing to do that no one had really seen it. It was basically a noir true crime drama, but it was flavored with Minnesota nice, right? Mm. And so, you know, when people, they talk like this, Mike, and then they got to go and they got to be like, you know, you just better think about that twice there, fella.
It's the darkness and the simplicity sort of like smashed
well,
together.
It's taking, it was taking an underrepresented culture, frankly, because, I mean, hey, we've seen a million movies take place in New York City and L.A. We've seen movies take place in like the South, you know, in the Ozarks, like Deliverance, right? Like we've seen gritty true crime take place all over the place. But in the middle of nowhere, North Dakota and Minnesota, like
it does kind of play with the Minnesota nice thing. Like that's sort 100%. Of part of the contrast. Yeah.
It's an important element of it. It's an important element of the flavor that makes it so special so especially not only are you setting a situation in a circumstance that is not often seen and has the impression of being the middle of nowhere, right? It's kind of like if you put something in the middle of nowhere, Kansas, only you move it up into like snow drifts and snow plains and things like that, and it feels even more isolated, or like putting it in the middle of like nowhere, Canada or something like that. But so not only do you have that interesting setting for it, you also have this Minnesota nice appeal where not only is this, these are just like blue collar folk, they're blue collar folk with a specific reputation for being the sweetest, kindest, and most passive aggressive people like in America, right? Like there's something, you know, I guess maybe the closest other approximation would be kind of like Southern charm or Southern hospitality.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's kind of a thing, you know, go down south.
Like a bless your heart sort of thing.
Yeah, bless your heart type thing. Well, the North has that too. And it's this Minnesota nice, right?
Yeah.
And so depicting your crime, your dark, gritty, you know, malevolence, you know, shrouded in Minnesota nice is, it's like peanut butter and chocolate, Mike. It was, it just went, it went real well together.
Well, and was it their first big movie? I feel like it was the Coen Brothers' first big one too. That kind of put them on the map. But again, I could be. I'm not going to pretend to like. Don't quote me on that.
They probably. Well, here's. I think that they reached more people than ever with Fargo, and so yeah, probably. I think I know what you mean by that. They had made movies that were really, really popular before, like Raising Arizona. Is one that came out in the 80s that's really well known. But even that is, I think that Fargo was more mainstream than some of the other stuff they'd done. Miller's Crossing and things like that previously. So I think they, maybe they did kind of make their name with Fargo, even though they have some precedent where people were definitely aware of them prior to. But it just, it was huge. It was huge in 96 when it came out. People loved this movie because it's fun. It's a fun movie, even though the movie itself is... For one, it's completely straight-faced, right? It takes every character takes themselves very seriously. It's not played for laughs. These are just like, well, you know, gosh darn it, I'm just trying to get this thing done here, you know, but they're being played straight. You know what I mean? They're being played for drama, right? And so that juxtaposition of like the heavy stakes of the tale and just the presentation, just the people who are the actors, the characters, is a really, really fun dichotomy.
It's like a really heavy dramatic irony, sort of.
It is. It's very ironic.
And then, yeah, with all of this, you know, and I made a reference to the wood chipper scene. So it's like you've got this, I mean, the violent scenes are grotesque too. Like, I mean.
Yeah, it culminates. It does. Yeah. So the basic premise here is that you have a car salesman who is trying to get a financial deal going, and he's married to the daughter of a rich businessman. And the rich businessman won't give him any money for this investment. So he concocts a plan to have his wife kidnapped for ransom. And then he would give the kidnapper some of the money, but he would keep most of the ransom money, which would be paid by his father-in-law, and use that for his investment. And then he'd be on Easy Street. And then what's happening, that's kind of taking place in the Twin Cities. And then what's happening simultaneously is that this kidnapping is taking place up near Fargo, which is on the border of North Dakota and Minnesota. You ever been there, Mike? Ever been to Fargo?
Yeah, you know, I feel like I have, but I can't like... Yeah.
I used to live in central Minnesota, and it wasn't that far away. So I can say that I have been to Fargo. But the kidnapping goes wrong. And basically, the people that get involved in order to do the kidnapping are actually way more vicious and kind of incompetent and kind of off the rails than the car salesman. Wonderfully played by William H. Macy, by the way.
In over his head.
Yeah. He gets in over his head real quick. And it's all because he makes a deal with the devil, so to speak. And it turns out that he has no control over these kidnappers. And
go figure.
Who could have seen this coming, right? So people end up dying. Innocent bystanders end up dying. And that involves the local police led by Sheriff...
Francis McDermott, right?
It's Francis Mc... Is it McDermott? I should have looked this up before this podcast, right? But Francis McDermott, that sounds right. Yeah, why do that, you know? She's the main character. Sheriff Gustafson... Or maybe I'm just mixing that up with
the show because
Grumpy Old Men. The guy's name is Gustafson.
Another Northern Minnesota show.
Another Minnesota movie.
Another
might be Gunderson. It might be Gunderson. Anyway,
classic Norwegian. Norwegian,
insert like, random Minnesota
Norwegian
sounding.
Lutheran like name.
Yeah,
whatever,
name so. Exactly. Yeah. Anyway, the police get involved, led by Francis. I'm Googling it because if I'm going to say her name wrong the entire episode, I don't want to do that.
Maybe because, AI can correct you.
Yeah, right.
But
keep going, Mike, or you say something.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, it kind of reminds me of like you have these, it's bringing together these different stories all together in this one main arc, right? And like you said, the main thread is first you have the fraud, the kidnapping fraud, or I don't know, you know, whatever. But then you've
Francis
also
McDormand.
Got Dormand.
Francis McDormand, and it is Marge Gunderson.
Okay, look at that. You're two for two.
Well, yeah, I guess.
One and a half.
I was calling her McDermott, which I'm pretty sure is
well,
a
that's,
guy. But
yeah.
Frances McDormand. She's great. I think she won. Did she win Best Actress for this? We're just like making
again,
stuff
yeah.
up. Yeah.
No, again, it's like, what? Why get bogged
down
in those sorts
yeah,
of...
Why,
you're supposed to be a storyteller, Jacob. Tell us... Yeah. Yeah, it's like...
Well,
so
I could
to be a
tell the story and just with confidence. And then I'd be like, oh, yeah, she won Best Actress for this movie. And
that's not part of the story. So anyway.
Okay, so anyway, the kidnapping goes wrong and lots of people die and nothing goes right. And at the end of the day, a whole lot of bad things happen that shouldn't have happened because this used car salesman got in over his head, got greedy, wanted to get the quick fix, and he ruined a lot of lives because of it. And that's all juxtaposed against the Minnesota Nice backdrop of the wholesomeness of Frances McDormand's character.
And on a positive note, because a lot of Coen Brothers movies get this sort of like characterization of like it's pure nihilism or it's just supposed to be like a nothing matters. And I'm not trying to conflate it with No Country for Old Men, but that's definitely, you know, the vibe that you get from No Country for Old Men. But the difference with this one, with Fargo, is you have this heroism in this small town law enforcement officer who, this is supposed to be like unheard of. Like you said, this was an untapped market for, you know, the grisly, gruesome, like true crime stories. And so we're supposed to be seeing this, you know, they've never seen anything like it. They're not ready for this sort of thing. They're not ready for, you know, professional like assassin or professional kidnappers or those sorts of characters. Mm-hmm. And so they should not know what to do with it. And yet we have this, this sheriff, or is she the deputy? Because isn't
sheriff.
It like the main?
She is the
okay,
sheriff.
So yeah. So, but we have this sheriff who, again, like she should be in way over her head. Kind of similar to William H. Macy, ironically, right? Mm-hmm. She's supposed to be in over her head, and yet she's the one who, you know, shows
she's super
this,
competent. Yeah.
It's kind of an underdog, like in a weird way, it's sort of like an underdog, like triumph of the simple kind of person.
The true theme of any Fargo property, and it starts in the movie and it carries through the TV shows and whatnot, is that the simple innocence and the simple effort to do good day to day will win out, or at the very least is the only thing we can do in the face of great evil, right? Mm-hmm. And so, and oftentimes there's a quasi happy ending of these things. Sometimes there's not. If you're talking about the TV shows, you know, like they can have some ambiguous endings, but
or like at least a sort of justice is served. Like if I'm thinking of season one of the TV show, at least.
Yes, that's true.
And the movie too. And the movie.
Well, And you said that some people call the Coens nihilist or whatever. I think that they play with nihilism, but I don't think that their stories are nihilistic.
No, I wouldn't say that either. I just, yeah.
I think that they oftentimes will have characters from all walks of life. And often they like to play with nihilistic characters, but that they're ultimately absurdist. That they like to point out
like
the kind of
after
absurdity.
Reading.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like
Every single one of their movies likes to play in absurdity. You know, the Big Lebowski is a good example. So they like to play with the randomness of
that's
life,
like a surrealist
the chance of
sort
life
of thing too. Yeah,
yeah, like the absurdity of life and all that stuff. And they set up these absurd happenstance type situations and then put characters in there and let them bounce off each other.
Well,
that's
and I'm not
a Coen
spend a ton of
recipe
time.
In a nutshell.
And I'm not going to spend a ton of time on this idea, but even you bringing that up, like those three elements of existentialism, nihilism, and surrealist, like absurdity, like those three things always, like oftentimes find themselves together. Like they're strange bedfellows, but they're common bedfellows.
Well, they're
so
like
you'll see.
Cousins, oh,
yeah.
basically. You know,
yeah.
Like, yeah. Well, you know, yeah, like
which makes them even stranger bedfellows to be to be fair. But that's and like those three ideas, like they were kind of swirling around the modern world all at around the same time. And so you'll see people like I wouldn't be surprised, I can't come up with like an interview off the top of my head, but that the Coen brothers would have been influenced by Albert Camus, for example, who was very much known in this kind of existentialist and absurdist kind of bent. Similar to, and then you have somebody who, even though he wouldn't have fallen into this camp of nihilism, but he was seen as sort of, I think in some ways inspiring to a lot of people who became nihilists, is like a Jean-Paul Sartre, who again was coming from that existentialist camp as well. So
I do think that you could probably call the Coen brothers existentialist storytellers. I do think that would actually be a relatively fitting thing, because existentialist doesn't necessarily imply nihilistic.
No,
like
it
you
shouldn't.
Said, they're close. They're close, but like they're you know, not quite the same thing. But they are interested in telling the stories of people set against a kind of like random chaotic universe, right? And so Fargo has that in spades.
Just sorry to put a point on that too, like existentialism shouldn't imply nihilism, because there's even a camp within Christian philosophy of Christian existentialism. Probably the most common example that people know of is like Soren Kierkegaard.
Oh, exactly.
But also
considered the father of existentialism is considered Soren Kierkegaard, and he was a Christian apologist.
And then, and then Dostoevsky, who a lot of Catholics and Orthodox look to as just somebody who really gets it, right? Who really gets
the Orthodox keep wanting to make him into a saint. You know, put like icons up in the church, but the church just won't let us, dang it. You know, so we all just kind of like, you
that's
know,
probably more Saint of a Russian thing, Jacob, yeah, than like it is. That's more of a Russian thing than an Orthodox thing, my guess is, but we don't want to get into politics.
Oh, man.
But also,
everyone loves Dostoevsky.
There's actually, Jacob, there's a strain within Catholic philosophy of, Thomist existentialism. So people who sort of reconcile the philosophy and theology of St. Thomas Aquinas with existentialism. And Gabriel Marcel and Jacques Maritain, who had a pretty big influence in kind of the World War I, post-World War II-ish sort of era when it came to Catholic philosophy and Christian philosophy in general. So it's one of those where, like you said, I just wanted to kind of piggyback on that point that existentialism, not only should it not be seen as the same as nihilism, but it shouldn't even be seen as like they are inherently like that one has to go with the other two.
Correlates or nothing like that. Yeah, it's true. And honestly, I actually, at the end of the day, in the kind of post-Christian world that we find ourselves living in or find developing around us, we're kind of all existentialist Christians.
I'm very sympathetic to it, if nothing else.
Like, it's,
I'm very sympathetic to that
it's
philosophy.
It's become a kind of necessary reality for anyone who's really kind of taking the conversation
to bring this
serious.
full circle, this is probably why we like the Coen brothers and Fargo so much. So that's probably why we're talking about it.
So here's the one thing. So we talked about this a little bit already, but they definitely have people in an absurdist universe, you know, bouncing off each other. And then the other thing I think that you'll find very common is that of the characters that they populate these tableaus with, you're going to have good, like the spectrum of humanity, right? So you're going to have like these ultimate evil characters, and you're going to have these ultimate good characters, and then kind of everyone in between,
like Billy Bob Thornton always, in Fargo season one. He's like, he's the monster.
We're going to move to, we're going to move to Fargo season one probably now, frankly, because
he's
the
mythical monster, basically.
He's the devil incarnate is what he is. He's literally a Satan figure. He's literally a deal with the devil. But just to put a quick pin in what I was about to say is that like, often, so you have a tableau of all these different characters, but then it almost feels inevitable that the most evil characters and the most good characters, well, I guess I shouldn't say this. There's actually a bunch of Coen movies that don't do this, but like a lot of their good ones, the evil and the good, they kind of are in, they are in fateful confrontation with each other, right? So, you know, Old Country, No Country for Old Men is an example of this. The True Grit remake is an example of this. Fargo is an example of this. Those ones come to mind off the top of my head. But basically, in this case, you have Marge Gunderson, who is pregnant, by the way. So not only is she, you know, a female cop, so already you have like a kind of like, oh, a female officer, you know, kind of thing, especially in the like,
now she's vulnerable, right? In this way too, right?
And not only is she a female police officer, she is a pregnant female police officer, and the bad guys that she is going up against are you have Steve Buscemi, who is great being Steve Buscemi. You know,
he's just the constantly same role. Complaining. Yeah, he's the same character in every movie,
snarky,
basically.
Complaining and stuff like that. And he has no idea that he's partnered with a psychopath, right? And so the other character, and I forget the actor who's playing him, I guess I still have it up, but he is a straight psychopath. He barely talks, and he is way crazier. Peter Stormare is his name, the actor who plays him. He's way crazier than anyone anticipates. And so Steve Buscemi thinks that he kind of has this under control. But his partner, this psychopath character who doesn't talk, he barely has a name. He's more of a force of nature in the movie.
Yeah.
And he just keeps making decisions because he doesn't care. He just doesn't care the consequences. Yeah, he's a wild card. And he's the inspiration for Malvo in Fargo season one. Mm. Only Billy Bob Thornton's character is fully fleshed out and way more interesting to watch because across 10 episodes,
he actually has time.
He has an opinion. You know, the thing about the character in Fargo, the movie, is that like he's a mystery. Like he's a shell. He's a shadow. Right. And so that has its own level of compelling narrative, you know, effect. But Malvo, played by Billy Bob Thornton, is way more charismatic and he's gleeful. He's like a gleeful nihilist. And like he's the devil, you know, he is that classic, like, I got a bargain for you, or
just
I'm going to come into your
burn.
Life.
Yeah. Just and wants I just to watch the world.
He just
burn.
Wants to, he just, he's going to watch the world burn and he's not going to care. And he's going to get what's his. And if people stand in his way, he'll kill them. And if they kill him, then so be it.
Well, and a really quick thing on that too is that he's not just like a wild animal, even though there are some scenes. Like I'm thinking of like Billy Bob Thornton's like death scene where he does that like growl, you know?
Yeah.
Right before.
Yeah.
But the thing
spoilers
is.
Spoilers alert for season
well,
one.
Okay.
Fargo.
Yeah. It's been what, 10 years now?
Yeah. It's been a while. Yeah.
But he's also a lot more calculating because he records all the conversations, which we know he's going to use as blackmail just in case. Like it's sort of him, his way of protecting himself, but it also becomes the undoing of Martin Freeman's character, Bilbo Baggins from the Hobbit trilogy.
Yep.
Also
Martin Freeman's great. Yeah. I love Martin.
Yeah.
Freeman.
And Watson from the Sherlock, BBC series as well.
That's right.
But of course that becomes the undoing. And again, it's sort of the evil consuming itself in a sort
evil
of way
hates
because,
itself. Yeah.
Because Martin Freeman is supposed to sort of be like the William H. Macy character of like he gets in over his head and he sort of thinks that he can like, he's also kind of a mix of like Steve Buscemi because he's trying to like control the Billy Bob Thornton character sort of.
Yeah.
Because when they're conspirators together and stuff.
Right.
And that's when, you know, obviously a lot of things happen throughout the season, but like he starts to sort of realize that he can't, but he tries to kind of get away from it. He almost does get away with it. Right up until that last.
Oh yeah.
Like
no,
the
only reason the bad guys get their comeuppance at the end of season one is they bring it upon themselves.
Yeah.
It really, the big rightfully theme of season one is that evil will eat itself. And so what you have is you have these good, wholesome characters. You have another female sheriff. You have a kind of bumbling, kind of beta male love interest for her, who's a Duluth police officer, a single father. And then you have her retired state trooper dad who runs a coffee shop now. And they're just simple folk making their way in the world. But she's got a ton of gumption and grit. And she knows that. I mean, the basic gist of season one is that Lorne Malvo, the Billy Bob Thornton character, comes through. He basically comes across Martin Freeman's insurance salesman character out of the blue, sees him being picked on, and is like, hey, I'll take care of that for you kind of thing. Wouldn't you like to see, you know, it's been a while since I've seen the first couple episodes of season one, but it's something like that. And that he ends up killing the guy and making Martin Freeman an accomplice. Martin Freeman ends up killing his wife because he's stressed out and it all just snowballs out of control kind of thing. But as the show progresses, Martin Freeman becomes more and more empowered and he becomes a truly successful individual on the back of all these heinous crimes that he's done. He frames his brother for the murder of his wife, you know, like he does truly deplorable things. Right. And so you're playing with themes of anyone's capable of doing super evil stuff. Because Martin Freeman is a super sympathetic character in like episode one.
Well, it goes back to your thing of the whole like Minnesota Nice, like passive aggressive nature of it, where it's like they would say sorry over and over again for stepping on your toes. But the shadow self, the shadow side of him is doing all these horrible things too. And that's the kind of the contrast that the first movie and then all the seasons are trying to set up as well.
Well, there's a famous Solzhenitsyn line, like the line between good and evil is drawn through the heart of every man or something like that. In other words, this idea that like human individuals are capable.
Someone listens
of
to Jordan
the greatest
Peterson.
Evil.
Just kidding. I'm sure you've read the Gulag Archipelago too.
Know, yeah. Well, just because Jordan Peterson totally made that up, you know, like, You know, yeah, but it's a good point. It's a good point, yeah. Is that like we're both, everyone's capable of the greatest evil and the greatest good. And these TV shows and these movies to a lesser, the movie to a lesser extent, but definitely in the TV shows, and especially season one, you see, you have a character who transforms from like a put upon but genuinely decent person into a monster, but a very, very successful climbing the ladder of life monster. You mm-hmm. have the Satan figure, you have the wholesome cop people, and they're all in conflict with each other and things like that. And then you have a bunch of other characters that represent all this different range of human kind of experience. But at the end of the day, they get away with it in season one. Eight episodes in, there's a year-long flash forward because the case stalls. To the best effort of all the good guys, they cannot nail the bad guys at the end of most of the events of season one. And then it flash forwards a year, and most people have moved on. The sheriff lady still has it as like a hobby pet project, trying to like make it work, but she's run out of like, she's run out of juice. You know, there's nothing more to do about it.
Yeah, they can't.
And so what happens is that.
Is it only a year too? I was thinking it was.
Yeah, I think it's just a year.
I believe you. I'm just like, well, was it only a year? But anyway, not to derail. Keep going.
And then, but then there's another chance interaction between Martin Freeman's character and Billy Bob Thornton's character.
In Vegas, Sin City, of all places.
Because, you know, where are you going to find the devil, man? And so, like, and that starts off a brand new sequence of events that results in Billy Bob Thornton wanting to kill Martin Freeman, coming back to Minnesota to kill Martin Freeman, and giving the good guys what they need in order to finally get the bad guys, ultimately. It starts a new set of dominoes that ends in the destruction of the bad guys. So
because
their own
what
actions.
Gets her back on the case too is that there's an incident in Vegas, and she knows that Martin Freeman was in Vegas, and so she's like, geez, trouble is following this guy, you know, what a coincidence. And that's what, again, she knows something smells fishy. That's a reference to another episode in season one. But
and if you really want to lay on some Christian commentary here, you know, like, Christians shouldn't believe in coincidence. So when you're watching a Coen Brothers movie, which loves to play with coincidence, loves to play with happenstance and things like that, as a Christian, you can sit there and bring God into that, because there is no such thing as coincidence. Like, everything is playing out. I believe in, like, happenstance, but happenstance is not the same thing as coincidence, because coincidence means that it was random and absurd and unintentional or whatever. Happenstance is like when two things that don't have anything to do with each other collide. But that's not because there wasn't something pushing those things together.
You just don't have a wide enough perspective.
Yeah, you just don't have the background. You don't have the God's eye view to see how they were going to collide, ultimately.
Yeah.
You know, we're living this out in real time kind of thing. So I'm a happenstance guy, but I'm not a coincidence guy. And so if you look at the happenstance of these Fargo
You're a Providence
stories,
guy, Jacob.
Yeah. I'm a Providence guy, yeah.
Yeah. LaVoy would love that.
I know. Shout out to Providence Academy in La Crosse, Wisconsin. But so anyway, season one of Fargo, it's fantastic. It's a great epic tale of good versus evil played out in like the humblest of people, right? And then, you know, fighting against the largest of villains in the he's like super nihilistic too. The hitman, he's a crazy nihilist. I don't know if we like really hit that, but we can move on. But like,
well, and one last thing, which it's not an accident that, you know, you've been talking about the Coen brothers and not just the existentialism and the absurdity, but a lot of people have talked about the that they bring their Jewish background, their Jewish heritage into it, and it's partially because of their own projects. So like, they've done a sort of modern retelling of the Book of Job with A Serious Man, which is a different movie that they made. And this is just me sort of off the cuff. I'm not saying that I can like back this up, but I was just thinking, like, wouldn't it be funny if like Fargo was sort of like, you could almost see it as the like a weird retelling of like the Book of Judges, because you think of like, and again, I'm not claiming this for sure, but it just made me think of like, you know, when you think of the events of like the cycles that take place in the Book of Judges, as you go throughout the entire book, it's sort of like the, again, not obviously in terms of the events that happen, but in terms of just like the cyclical nature of the stories and how it always kind of brings you back. You know, you kind of go around and you sort of be brought back to where you started. And it's usually these like simple people who are brought up or chosen by God for this big purpose or this big opportunity. And it oftentimes will involve some sort of miraculous or, like you said, happenstance event, or it's sort of a God's timing when it comes to these things taking place. And it's been a while since I watched it too, but isn't there a reference of like the plagues, or isn't there a reference to like Moses something too in one of the episodes?
We did an entire conversation about Fargo season one. I forgot an entire story arc, which is the supermarket
like
king,
too.
The supermarket king of Minnesota. Well, it also kind of keeps Malvo around because he's trying to blackmail the supermarket giant. But he's Greek Orthodox, shout out. Or at least they asked that. I guess it doesn't necessarily confirm that he's Greek Orthodox, but like kind of implies it. He's a Greek guy and he's religious. And what Lorne Malvo starts to do is start to recreate the plagues of Moses in this man's life to basically make him go insane so that he can get a bunch of money out of him, kind of thing. He starts to blackmail him and act like it's kind of like coming from God. So he's really just like kind of playing God, you know, with this guy. So another kind of like Satan reference there. That's a fun arc, frankly.
That's like just a one episode. That's almost like a what's it called? A bottle episode. It's almost like a bottle episode
it takes place across the show, but like there's different episodes that put more emphasis on because well, anyway, it's a tangent. But like,
I just wanted to, that should be sort of factored in when we're talking about the different themes of Fargo is what would have been influencing the Coen brothers in their story writing and their storytelling. But we haven't done anything on 5 yet, and you wanted to talk about season 5 too. So let's just jump from season 1 all the way to 5, and we'll kind of close out with that one too.
Yeah. So in so doing, here's what I want to say: Fargo season 1, everyone loves that. It's a great season. It's fantastic storytelling. Fargo season 2 is probably my personal favorite. I think it's really up there in storytelling. But I also kind of acknowledge that I think that it has a lot to do with my own personal tastes. And so Fargo season 2 is about a gang war that happens in the 1970s between Kansas City and a Fargo crime syndicate and the little people that get caught up. That actually accidentally start the gang war and then get caught up in the consequences of it, right? So for a lot of reasons, I love that season, and it's probably my favorite. I love the setting of the 1970s. I love the kind of nostalgia of it. I love a good gangland crime story, you know? Gangs at war with each other is always tickling me. And I love the cast in that one, just like the actors that are playing the characters and the characters themselves.
Is Chris Rock in that one?
No, that's in number 4.
That's in 4. Okay.
Season 4, yeah. And season 2, it's Kirsten Dunst is one of the people who I've pretty much had a crush on my entire life. Call me Kirsten. I mean, I'm married and I have a bunch
Jumanji
of kids.
It's Jumanji.
Jumanji. Yeah, no, it was probably Bring It On back in high school. No, it was Interview with the Vampire. There you go. Kind of snotty in that one. Anyway, we're like the same age. Anyway. Kirsten Dunst and us were like
that's
the same
your
age.
In, right?
So
that's,
we're like, we grew up together. I watched her grow up. Anyway, so, but it's also got, why can't I think of his name? I love that guy. The
Jesse
State Trooper.
Pinkman.
Well, he's. No, he's not. I don't know who you're talking about.
I was thinking of, Breaking Bad is his character's name, but we're all over the place.
The main character, State Trooper guy, I can't think of his name right now, but I love that guy too. I like season 2 a lot. I also feel like season 2 is still just telling a good story, and that it's still just kind of like playing with the themes of the Coen brothers and things like that. And it's just
Jacob?
Yeah.
But where does it
after season 2, season 3, I think it starts to, it's at that like slope and like the ball is tittering there, you know, season 3 is playing with themes that would have been relevant in like 2015 with like, you know, President Trump coming in and
starting to become a
Russian interference and things like that. Yeah. The Russians are the bad guys in season three.
Well, it's that's just about, them trying like, to be the 80s. Business. That's just them going back to the 80s.
So. Yeah. No, but that takes place in like 2007 or something like that is when like the show takes place in 3-3. But, you know, it's a little tangential still. By the time you get to season four, that jumps back to the 1950s, and it's a gang warfare season again between Italians and black mafia, like Italian mafia and black mob or whatever. And so that's all very much about race and things like that. And again, this is kind of during like 2019, I think, is when this one was airing, maybe. Mm-hmm. And so it's really timely. George Floyd stuff's on the horizon, but you know, the race conversation in America was really picking up steam.
Yeah. Heating up.
And then by the time you get to season five, it's the most, because even season four, it's like, I see what this story is about. It's about racism in America. And it's like, that's fine. You can tell that story. Like, let's have a story about racism in America. Sure. But the more and more you turn your stories into kind of like political tirades or cultural commentaries on America, on society, right?
Well,
as opposed to the more universal themes of good versus evil from like seasons one and two.
Yeah.
The more you plant them in the soil of like current events and culture war issues and things like that, you're going to lose some vitality. It's not going to be monomythic anymore. It's going to be specific and it's going to be dated to this era.
It goes from art to propaganda, and it's a spectrum. It's a continuum. It's not like it's immediately one or the other, but you're starting to, like you said, kind of veer in that direction, and it starts to smell more and more like propaganda, even if it has a lot of the facets of art. And that's what can sometimes make it confusing. It can also be what makes it effective propaganda.
Well, let me just,
it also will devalue it ultimately, right? Take away that transcendence you were talking about.
And I do want to clarify, I highly recommend you watch this entire series. Like, watch them all. Like,
give me your Hulu account, Jacob. Yeah. Give me that Hulu. Give me that Hulu username. I mean, never mind. Yeah,
what? Yeah. Like, they're still really, really well crafted hours of storytelling. Though, again, like, the more kind of, I'll just say it, the more ham-fisted it gets, the more the storytelling actually starts to suffer, too.
Well, and it leaves a bad taste in your mouth after.
Well, it's not just that. It's just, like, sometimes, like, if you're really trying to, like, make a moralizing point with the characters, then you have to have characters start making, like, dumb decisions because that fits their cookie-cutter mold better than what feels organic or logical to the character. And so I think that starting in season five, you get more and more like, no, these are the archetypes, these are the characters, the cutouts that we're coloring in, and they need to make choices that serve this plot kind of thing. And so it does start to actually affect the storytelling as well. But that being said, there's a ton of good stuff in season four and five for that matter. And the craft itself is great. Like, they're
really
well executed.
It takes away from the providence aspect or the eucatastrophe, because now it becomes, like you said, it has to be more, it has to be more cookie cutter. It has to be like, well, this is the color by number. Like, this is going to happen here. This is going to happen here. It feels more arbitrary. And what's ironic too is, so even though we're recording this months later, this is coming out right after our Fall of the House of Usher, where the same thing happens in the Netflix Mike Flanagan Fall of the House of Usher series. Mm-hmm. And it's the same complaints, even though different showrunner, different producer, different, you know, streaming service, but it's still happening. And different issues too, right? I mean, this was trying to kind of put forward or propagandize different issues than the Fall of the House House of Usher was, but it's doing the same. It's the same kind of mechanism.
And you know, what's really funny about it to me, what's frustrating about it to me is that, like, I do watch a lot of content, or at least my fair share, that's for sure. There's way too much movies and television to just like keep up with in perpetuity, but I've it seems like every creator, content creator, or TV show series that I really have historically enjoyed, they just all seem to be falling into this kind of like politicized basket. They all seem to be going the same. So I love Mike Flanagan's output, but the most recent stuff he's done feels like it's trying to make a point. I love the Fargo TV show, but the most recent seasons feel like they're trying to make a point. And hey, you know what? TV show, like, content creators can make points. They're here. It's their show, and they can do that.
That's but the like, prophetic nature, right? Of the
sure,
of you the know, myth. The prophetic. Go back to episode blank of the show. We talked about that before. The prophetic nature of myth. But
anyway. If you're making a show that's for everybody, as in like universal, and where you're playing with universal themes, then everyone can enjoy it. And if you're making a show that has a very specific worldview that wants to make a commentary on modern society, current society, with that specific worldview, that is no longer a show for everybody. And so Fargo season 5 is not a show for me. They did not make Fargo season 5 for Jacob. And that is very clear, you know. Fargo season 5 is, and I actually watched its, they have a few like behind the scene clips, you know. So after it was finished, I was like, I'll watch some of these, you know, little 5-minute like behind the scenes with the cast of Fargo season 5 stuff. And yeah, sure enough, you know, as if it wasn't so obvious, the points they're trying to make in the TV show, they do go ahead on record and say it as producers and TV show creators in the interviews. It's like, this season we're talking about toxic masculinity and Trump mega politics. And it's like, yeah, I see what you did there. You definitely were making a TV show about toxic masculinity and Trump era politics. And that is what like season 5 is. Is
The Last of Us made for you, Jacob? Because this sounds similar to our Last of Us conversation. And what do you go and do? And you look behind the veil and you ruin it for yourself and you see the interviews with the producers and the showrunners.
I waited till after the TV show to because I didn't want to hear their opinions. I wanted to just take it as they gave it to me, kind of thing. And then, but they were pretty crystal clear in their storytelling, like what they thought. And hey, I'll go on the record and say that I am not some kind of like mega hat wearing fellow, actually. We're going to call me someone who has opted out of politics. I still vote, but I'm not a fan of either political party at this point.
Politically homeless.
I am politically homeless, I think is pretty accurate. I mean, I'm a pretty conservative fellow, but I am politically homeless and I am not a tremendous fan of Donald Trump. I'm really not. But I know
we're
a lot
really
of people
click
who
for
are
this one. You got to put this in the hashtags, Jake.
Yeah, right. I know a lot of people who are though, and they're friends of mine, and I like those people. So I am 100% friends with Trump supporters. Some of the best people I know are Trump supporters.
If we didn't think our last episode was going to be our last one, now we can pretty much put the nail in the, you know, we're putting the nail in the coffin and it's not even a vampire episode.
Yeah, I know, right? And I'm good friends with people who are not Trump supporters, right? I might even be on a podcast with someone who doesn't support Trump, but that's a conjecture. Pure conjecture.
I was going to say, we've never had that conversation. I'm probably less political than you are. We haven't had that conversation.
All right. So Mike actually does fully support Donald Trump. Yes. That's what I just gathered out of that.
You're cutting this out, right? You're cutting all of this. You're cutting the last like 5 minutes out, right?
That's mega red you're wearing, isn't it, Mike? Maybe
this is Ron Swanson red. This is Ron Swanson red.
I like Ron Swanson. Ron Swanson is basically the villain of Fargo season 5.
Yeah,
by
the
way,
another level.
Roy Tillman is his character. He's played by John Hamm, and he's actually another strong villain for the show. I'll say this much: he's introduced in episode 2, and his introduction is super charismatic. I mean, I think that there are some people who watch his introduction would watch season 2 of episode 5 and find him to be a terrible, horrible monster. If you only watch Roy Tillman, Roy Tillman in episode 2, if that's the only episode you see, it's a good litmus test for who you are as a person. So there are some people who are going to hate that guy. And then there's people like me who are going to find him to be their like new spirit animal.
John Wayne. Yeah.
Yeah. He's awesome. Roy Tillman is awesome in episode 2 of Fargo season 5. He becomes the most black hat wearing evil villainous person ever as that show goes on. So I can no longer say that I want to be like Roy Tillman. All I ever knew about Roy Tillman was what his actions are and who he is in Fargo episode 2, that guy's awesome. He doesn't stay awesome. He turns into the most evil, and like not evil in a compelling way like Lorne Malvo is in season 1. And just like a bad guy way. Yeah, like you know, he kills the women that aren't subservient enough to him, you know. Child brides, you know, he gets his women from the teenage well, you know, almost, like,
I mean,
he slaps people around if they don't listen to him. Like, he is just so like, okay.
And I don't say this like as if I naively don't think that this doesn't exist or those people don't exist, but the whole point of making a compelling TV show is to not make caricatures. And when you have created a caricature, it's like you might as well have the eyes widen and it become the, you know, jackpot symbol and the tongue roll out of the mouth, because that's you've now created a cartoon. It just happens to look like flesh and blood.
He is, by the end of the show, he's a total cartoon. The entire premise is that his second wife is on the run from him. She manages to escape his abusive relationship. She is his child bride. Like, she was like 15 or 16 when he married her or something like that. And she escapes and she goes into hiding with a different identity for 10 years. And she, in the first episode, ends up in the police database because she's at, get this, Mike, a school. What are those things called when the parents go to the school and they yell about banning books and things like that?
Oh, just like an open forum or
town hall thing or whatever. The show opens with one of those and it's all these angry parents yelling at and it turns into a mob and it turns into a fight and all the parents start fighting each other or whatever. And she gets caught up in that. And that's how she ends up in jail with her fingerprints in the system. And that's how he discovers her. So they're hitting on the whole parents being angry at schools thing. And it's not painted in a positive light.
There's another kind of layer of metaphor too, because I mean, what are a lot of times those banning books like arguments about is about the certain material that's in it and how it's oftentimes put forward as, you know, if we don't have this material for kids, they're going to end up getting hurt. And what do we have in your story is we have a character who started out as a kid and because of this public forum, she ends up getting hurt in the arc of the whole episode. So it is, I mean, I say it's an interesting metaphor in the way that it's, you know, brought about sort of this like longer arc. But like you said, ultimately it amounts to a sort of ham-fisted, you know, rip from the headlines kind of piece of propaganda.
You're way more charitable towards it than I am, frankly.
Oh, but well, like, as in most things, Jacob. Yeah. As in most things.
Yeah. So anyway, the whole show is about him trying to get his wife back. Because even though now he's married to a third woman named Karen, that's right. His third wife is named Karen, folks. And she's a dutiful, internalized misogynist who is super subservient and takes her slaps like a good woman should.
I think they call that trad wife. Trad wife is what they call that nowadays.
Yeah, I'm sure what the creators of that TV show would call her a trad wife. Yeah. Instead, they called her Karen. And so even though he has a third wife, you see, his second wife, she ran out on him and she's got a debt to pay, Mike. And so even though he's moved on and has kids of his own and she has a daughter now with her new husband who is not a toxic male, quote unquote. In other words, he is a very soft-spoken, very polite, kind of dumb, like, hey, let's just go make pancakes, guys. Like, let's go, pet some bunnies somewhere. You know, like, that's her new husband.
That's the beta thing that we've
already seen. Yeah, and he's the perfect husband. She loves him. He's the best. The show never depicts him as anything other than worthy of her admiration. And he is a very soft-spoken fella. And, you know, like, let's just get along, everybody. So he's the opposite of Roy Tillman, who's like the John Wayne character. Everything about season five is just so on the nose, so overwhelmingly antagonistic towards any type of traditionalism. And also, ultimately, Roy Tillman is the leader of a militia that upholds the Constitution, but doesn't believe in the sovereignty of the executive branch. So like when the feds show up, he dismisses them as not valid, right? And they're militia types. They're patriots, right? Like they're the patriot militia types. And
yeah,
when things really start to fray at the end of the TV show, there's a big confrontation between the federal governments and the patriots on the Roy Tillman compounds. And did I also mention that this all takes place during an election cycle where Roy Tillman is running for sheriff once more? So there's a whole political, like, he's got an election to win, and it ends with him revolting against the United States government. So where have we seen that before? You know, I don't know. Yeah. It's fascinating storytelling, folks. And then also,
you couldn't make this stuff up, Jacob.
No, it's like, well, novel. And then, you know what I was saying earlier about how like a TV show can like start to make poor storytelling decisions when it's trying to like shove through its program. One of the characters in the show is the mother of the main character lady, Dot, the mother-in-law, I should say. And she is the queen of debt, they call her. She is a debt. I don't even know. Like, she's like a debt lady. She like handles people's debt. But she's like a villainous. Like,
you see,
she's like a villainous corporate Republican lady.
It's like, yeah, we'll cut your debt in half. Like, you know, the sort of
influential. Yeah, she like she accrues debt, and then she's a Republican in the TV show. She is she's the gives to the Federalist Society. She helped put Trump into office because she calls in a favor for him at the end of the TV show. You know, like, so she is not a West Coast liberal, let's say, right? But what she is a super empowered female, right? And so she is, and so half the show is her putting men in their place because she has more power than them, because she has more money than them. She's like super wealthy and stuff like that. So that's the other thing is by this point, like, we've gone from a TV series that really focuses on like blue collar people and just like the little guy just like fighting the forces of evil in their day-to-day life. And now we're talking about like movers and shakers, you know, we're talking about like billionaires and things like that. It's a different vibe.
It's House of Cards now. It's the,
it
became the Netflix House of Cards series, which that, you know, for a lot of reasons sort of kind of devolved by the end of it too, for me, so other reasons, but
here's what I want to point out though is that like by the end of the show you have a character who, she's not pleasant, but and honestly, even by the metric of like, we'll just say like a West Coast kind of liberal mentality, she's a Trumpite, she's a Trump supporter, you know, I mean, she's cynical about it, she calls him the orange idiot, you know, but she's she's on the wrong side of politics as far as what her financial donations go to. But the show paints her as like a, she starts out despising Dot, her daughter-in-law, as just like a kind of like a money grabbing chick who latched onto her son for the money kind of thing is how she sees her. But by the end of the show, they have this like reconciliation where it's like, oh, I've seen the years of abuse that you put up with. And I see that you're actually a truly strong woman who doesn't just want my son for the money, but because you're like a good, strong female person. And so like they have this, like, she turns into a good guy. The mother-in-law is like a good guy by the end of the show. But what? It's hard for me to explain this in real time because nothing I said sounds bad the way I described it.
I was going to say, that's called a redemption arc, Jacob.
Yeah, no, it's more about
the flavor. Against redemption?
Yeah, exactly. That's what it sounds like. No, it's like they turn her into a hero because she has the power to do evil things to other people. And they do it, they turn her into someone who is like, rah-rah, you're my daughter now, and I accept you as my daughter now, and things like that.
Well,
but like, she's not she's not redeemed at all.
It's a replacement.
She uses her money to punish Roy Tillman, for example.
It's a replacement of goodness for power, or it's an equation of goodness with power. And so now, you know, she decides what's good, or, you know, she becomes the quote unquote good guy because of either the empowerment, right, that she represents, or is sort of able to, because it's almost like kind of what you were describing.
Her redemption arc is using her money to punish bad men.
There's really no redemption is kind of that's the issue too, to kind of take away is. Mm-hmm.
Well, and so you have this lady who she goes in, like Roy Tillman ends up in prison, and she goes in and is like, hey, I've used all these people, because all these poor people in prison, they all have debt. And so I've basically made an open call to everyone in prison that if you have debt affiliated with me, I will forgive your debt if you make Roy Tillman's life a living hell for the rest of his life. So she literally uses her debts. She doesn't just like forgive the debt. She uses her leverage over people in order to like rain vengeance down upon her enemy, right? That's how her story ends. And then the very next scene, you have another conversation.
Yeah. We're supposed to cheer. Yeah.
And you have a scene where literally the TV show, an assassin hitman guy is a part of this season, and he comes and he's like, hey, we still have unfinished business, you and me. There's a debt to be paid. And Dorothy's like, why do debts have to be paid? Maybe sometimes it's better just to forgive those debts, right? Hey, I love that message. I love that story. But this TV show wants to have two heroines, Dot and the mother-in-law. They're both painted as heroes by the end of the TV show.
It kind of reminds me of The Unforgiving Servant a little bit, where it's like, well, you know, you're not really willing to forgive the debt in her case of all of these people in jail, and yet you still expect that same treatment of a much greater debt, let's say. And like, I don't know all the circumstances, but that is sort of how it's kind of appearing to me, is it's kind of an inversion of that Unforgiving Servant parable. I do still want, and like, I always kind of told myself eventually I would go back to, you know, the seasons of Fargo that I missed. And so, you know, that's my gentle nudge to, you know, give me your Hulu account or whatever. But, so I'm definitely willing to, cause like you said, if it's getting to sort of engage with these topics and ideas and these questions, and I'm always going to, you know, whenever a Coen Brothers movie, or property comes out, I'm gonna give it, you know, give it at least one watch, or give it some attention.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of fun stuff in season five, to be honest. And the show itself is always really well crafted, very well edited, very well, good storytelling, right? Just sometimes the story, I think the stories have been waning across time, but I highly recommend it. Go watch it for yourselves, folks, and see what you think.
Engage these sort of questions and leave all of your positive political comments for Jacob in the emails and in the replies and everything like that. And and you know, leave a positive review. It helps get this show out there to more people, so that we can kind of just keep engaging with all the different, you know, even if it's propaganda, we'll keep engaging with the art and the propaganda and how that kind of meets with our Christian view of reality and of the world. So thank you, guys.
And you know, Mike, you should have done that in a little bit more of an accent like this.
Yeah.
Because sure you like and subscribe there, fellas, because that's the best thing you can do for this here podcast for us.
Are you going to put my face on William H. Macy for this? Is that what the artwork is going to be?
Oh, you betcha.
Thanks for listening to Voyage Podcast. The Voyage Podcast is a production of Voyage Comics and Publishing, which seeks to create exceptional entertainment informed by Catholic values that inspire people to live a heroic life. Voyage Comics seeks to advance truth and beauty found in powerful stories. To learn more, visit voyagecomics.com. You can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram